Right-wing extremist groups have been on the rise in the U.S., and since the election, they've become even more violent. That's where we start the show today on Thursday, December 17th. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Also on the show, 2020 has been a difficult year, so we're hearing from you about how your faith has been tested during these trying times.
There were times I really thought I was going to die alone, and I really reached out to God in those times, and I really started to reconnect.
Plus, press freedom around the world has been under attack, with journalists being beaten, imprisoned, and in some instances, killed for just doing their jobs.
We would love President-elect Biden to make a very strong declaration when he takes office of how his administration will support press freedom so that the U.S. will walk the walk.
And we round out the show with a sweeter topic, the history of the holiday cookie. But first, last Saturday, far-right demonstrators, some of them armed and wearing bulletproof vests, protested the results of the presidential election in Washington, D.C. and in state capitals around the country.
USA! 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 USA!
They burned Black Lives Matter banners from two historic black churches in Washington, D.C., and some of the protesters also incited violence. Four people in D.C. were stabbed, and one person was shot in Washington state. These instances are just some of the latest in the intensifying rise of right-wing violence in the United States. Just this week, a Republican mayor in Kansas resigned after receiving death threats for putting forward a mask mandate. Throughout his presidency, Donald Trump has wavered between outright disavowal and support of these groups. But this statement at the first presidential debate was a direct appeal to a group called the Proud Boys, one of the protesters in D.C. over the weekend.
Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
Just this week, a social media account for the Proud Boys claimed, quote, "There's been a Proud Boy at the White House for 4 years. Now, as President Trump's administration nears its end, these violent groups show no signs of slowing down when President-elect Biden takes office. For more, I'm joined by Heidi Beirich, co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. Heidi, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
And Ryan Devereaux is a staff investigative reporter at The Intercept covering Homeland Security. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Heidi, we're calling these groups far right. How should we be defining these groups? Who are we talking about when we talk about far right extremist groups?
Well, this has been an agglomeration of groups, for example, from armed militias, as well as out and out white supremacists, and then at times, supporters for Trump that may not align with those same views. And there's a mix when you talk about, for example, the Proud Boys. They're, anti-immigrant, anti-Islam, misogynistic, often have white nationalists in their ranks. So this is a whole host of all different kinds of extremism. And I think far right's the fairest term to apply.
Ryan, you have reported on one of the groups that we're looking at today, the Proud Boys in Portland. What are their protests like? And we should note here that one of their leaders is not white, and I think that's something that requires a little bit of examination. So, Ryan, tell us about them.
Yeah, so as Heidi mentioned, the Proud Boys are a group that is sort of exists among a larger ecosystem of far-right groups. And I attended a rally that they held in Portland, which has been a repeated site of a lot of their violent attacks on the city for several years now. That particular protest late September was held as a sort of demonstration, they build it, encountering domestic terrorism. And so the way in which this group in particular kind of couches their politics is that they see themselves as kind of an auxiliary of the state. And in a city like Portland, which had become the site of so much political contention over the protests there following the killing of George Floyd, their argument was that they were there to sort of support the police who were either unwilling or unable to do their jobs because of the leftist Democrats that were controlling the city. So they held this rally, which turned out to be a bit of a flop, where they gathered basically in a muddy field and drank hard seltzers and chanted about Antifa. and walked around carrying their guns and their tactical gear. And you know, thankfully for the city of Portland, it didn't devolve into violence. But that has been the state of affairs in that city for several years now under Donald Trump. Proud Boys coming to town, mixing about in the city, confronted by anti-fascists, violence ensues. But, you know, I think in terms of, you know, their leader, Enrique Tarrio, a gentleman who you mentioned, not being white, he's Cuban and he is from Florida. And, he was there at the protest, kind of discussing his politics with reporters. And something that he mentioned that comes up a lot with the Proud Boys is a couple of sort of political cores, which is anti-leftism. They really rally around being sort of anti-leftists, and they wear these patches with the letters RWDS, which stands for right-wing death squads. Some of them have that tattooed on their bodies. They see themselves as an extension of that history, which is, I think, frankly, quite chilling. And the other kind of core that they rally around is guns. Guns are central to these guys. It's a huge part of their movement, an idea that the Second Amendment is under attack. It really comes up a lot in a lot of their rhetoric.
Heidi, everything that Ryan just laid out there, and particularly the RWDS, the Right Wing Death Squad connection, is pretty terrifying. In terms of who has deputized these folks, who are largely men, largely white men, to see themselves as sort of a self-appointed militia, to who's really given these groups the idea that they have the right to roam the streets indiscriminately with guns pointing them any which way they please?
Well, I mean, look, we have to lay a lot of the blame here at the feet of President Trump. You know, you played a clip earlier of Trump calling, you know, speaking directly to the Proud Boys in one of the debates, and also talking about how somebody needs to do something about Antifa. Well, as Ryan just explained, you know, the Proud Boys and similar groups view Antifa as their, you know, enemies, the main group of people that they need to confront. A lot of the activities we saw in D.C. at the Proud Boys rally, which also involved other folks, was about a bunch of chanting against Antifa and against the left. And that right-wing death squad idea goes right to the heart of that. But, you know, we have now suffered 4 years of a president who has encouraged, retweeted, you know, supported everything from QAnon conspiracy folks to, you know, right-wing extremists. And that's what's really ginned this movement up and made it much larger, better organized, more street savvy than it was 4 years ago. And this is a really unfortunate legacy, one of the worst legacies of this particular administration.
Heidi, are we actually seeing a rise in, I don't know, I mean, I would loosely say membership here or affiliation with groups like this? Or is it just that these groups have become more public?
Yeah, well, I think both things have happened. I think there's a lot more supporters, especially when you start looking in the online space and you can actually sort of count the individuals involved in different networks and forums. There's also been a rise, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, of about 50% in the number of white nationalist groups between 2018 and 2019. I'm sure that's going to continue to go up. So these are real-world effects, but they're also more public, right? They're more on the streets than they were 4 years ago. So these two things are happening at the same time.
Ryan, a lot of people, obviously, it's no surprise that this country is polarized politically right now. How much of that is connected to the radicalization of largely white men in these groups?
I think it's intimately connected to the rise of these groups. I think that beyond the membership in organizations like the Proud Boys, I think there's a broader cultural problem with young men in general, finding themselves feeling alienated, angry, full of grievances, and building communities in online spaces or diving into algorithm-fueled rabbit holes online that just further fuel their perception of persecution, vast conspiracies arrayed against them, and political correctness that is challenging them or making them feel as though they are attacked. and they dig in deeper and deeper in these worlds, and the results can be really dangerous for them and for the rest of society and communities. And you add into that mix 2 decades of endless war in this country, really intense and entrenched gun culture, and you have an extremely volatile mix.
Heidi, I want to talk about the use of the word radicalized. It's something that we heard many years ago when we, at least politicians, and would use this term to talk about Muslim Americans and Muslims from abroad, and make that connection to terrorism. Now, we don't tend to hear that word used as directly with white militias and white Americans who themselves are becoming radicalized by these conspiracy theories and ideologies, whether it's the media or politicians. Why is that?
Well, I mean, there has been a reluctance to look at white supremacy and being radicalized into white supremacy as a serious a threat as people getting, you know, sucked into Islamic extremist movements. I think that's starting to shift now, but really in the era since 9/11 all the way through the Obama administration, this was not something we talked about. But the facts now are there are more domestic terrorist attacks by white supremacists in this country than by, for example, ISIS supporters. So this is no longer something you can turn away from. And in the last year, DHS, FBI, the State Department, they've all issued reports of some sort or another saying that white supremacy is the main place to look for our future terrorism problems. And we got to look this right in the face. We can't act like our backyard isn't what's fueling the El Paso attack, the Tree of Life attack, and so on. But that reluctance to deal with this issue for so long has left our, you know, national institutions a little hamstrung with dealing with this particular threat.
Ryan, you work on this. This is your beat. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, on the use of words like radicalized and other parallels, really, to domestic terror? I mean, should the media, in your opinion, and politicians in particular, be much more direct about what we're talking about here?
Yes, I do. I do think the media and politicians should be more direct in what we're talking about here. It gets quite complicated when we start talking about terrorism and how we talk about terrorism in this country, you know, coming, you know, nearly 2 decades out from September 11th, you know, during the Obama administration, spent a lot of time covering the manifestations of the war on terror at home and how it was directed at Muslim communities and this sort of incredible power that our federal law enforcement investigative agencies have in the realm of counterterrorism and how that was wielded against communities of color, particularly Muslim and immigrant communities. And so it's a little unnerving sometimes when we talk about domestic terrorism in the context of Trump. You'll hear arguments that the government doesn't have the tools that it needs, that it needs more authorities and power to do these sorts of investigations, when the problem, it seems, has not been a lack of authorities and powers. I do think that language matters a lot here, and sort of the road that I was going down is the argument that I was making is that in the case of what we tend to call domestic terrorism in the United States when we're referring to far-right groups, at times this argument crops up that the authorities don't have the powers that they need to target these groups, when in fact they have extensive powers. And the problem that we've seen historically has been a will to use those powers against groups on the right. And that could be shifting a bit now, but I do believe that there's a lot of work to be done, and it doesn't necessarily and perhaps should not involve expanding the powers of investigative agencies, because the expansion of those powers historically has led to them being used against Muslim communities, communities of color, immigrant communities. What we need is a sort of change in will to target the groups on the far right.
Heidi, your thoughts on that? Because part of the struggle, I think, in terms of finding these groups and rooting them out is also sometimes the connection between right-wing extremists and law enforcement itself.
Yeah, well, I generally agree with everything Ryan said there. I think that the authority that federal law enforcement has to deal with these issues is there. It's a matter of willpower, right? A wish to look at these things. And I don't think, for example, the idea of a new domestic terrorism statute is a good idea for exactly the reasons Ryan said. We tend to see these things boomerang back and actually harm communities of color, you know, violate civil rights. Now, that said, I think there are things that need to be done. For example, extremists have to be rooted out of the military. We have to take a look at what is happening in law enforcement agencies and who they're allowing to serve as police officers, and perhaps change some of that. We need to look at hate crimes and what is being done on that front. How are we collecting the data? How you know, serious are hate crimes taken? In other words, there are a whole host of measures that can be used to solve, or at least attempt to solve, the problem of white supremacy in this country and its connection to violence.
We have a new presidential administration coming in, Heidi, and I think a lot of folks were thinking, well, we'll just turn the page from the past 4 years and go into a new chapter of American culture and history. And frankly, I suspect that Pandora's box has been opened by the Trump administration when it comes to a lot of these far-right groups. And I don't think it's going to be easy to close it, regardless of whether or not Joe Biden is president. So your thoughts, and Ryan, I'd love to hear from you as well, on what happens next.
Well, I think what you're saying is exactly right. These groups are now emboldened, larger, organized. You know, the internet has provided a huge area to radicalize more people into these ideas. The president's rhetoric about the election being stolen or being a fraud has them very, very ginned up. We're hearing talk about civil war. I mean, I'm very worried about what January 20th is going to mean as a flashpoint. And these people aren't going to go away. They're going to be here all through the Biden administration, and they're going to be a problem. At least we won't have a president who is sort of directly speaking to them and rallying them up. But these formations and forces aren't going to disappear.
Brian, we've opened Pandora's box. Where does the federal government go from here? Where do Americans go from here with this?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with everything Heidi said. And yes, in a sense, Pandora's box was opened with Trump's inauguration in 2017, but I think it's also important to look back to the inauguration, you know, nearly a decade before Barack Obama, and understand that the forces that we're talking about right now, the movement that we're talking about right now, preceded Donald Trump, and Donald Trump largely rode in on a thing that was there before him and percolating before him in the face of the election of the first black president. There was an uptick in organizing and activism in these spaces. And the Department of Homeland Security's top analyst researching these issues warned about this at the time, warned that there are groups mobilizing, that issues like immigration are bringing them together. They're recruiting in the military. I mean, so this, and really, you can go back even before the Obama administration. There have been these waves, these moments in history, often associated with wars abroad, that come boomeranging back domestically into this country. And it's that sort of feedback loop of militarism abroad that really helps to drive the militarism that we see at home. And so this problem is just so much deeper and so much more entrenched than the administration of Donald Trump being or not being in power.
Gabriel Sterling, a couple of weeks ago, made some pretty passionate appeals in the Georgia State House to stop this and stop threats and stop the radicalization.
It has all gone too far. All of it. Joe DeGeneva today asked for Chris Krebs, a patriot who ran CISA, to be shot.
Is it too late for the GOP in particular or people like Sterling to say things right now? I mean, is it too little, too late?
Well, it's unfortunate that the people in the GOP didn't take a harder stand beforehand. What Sterling said is somebody's going to get shot. And unfortunately, I think that's right. They've unleashed something by discrediting this election that is going to be with us for a long time. They've also ginned up conspiracy people like the QAnon folks who are actually involved in a lot of the targeting of poll workers and people who work on voting machines here in Georgia. And at this point, 50% of Republicans think that QAnon is a good thing for the country. Those forces are not going away.
I've seen people, Heidi, who I've known for many, 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 many years, who are now, and I've heard from friends and acquaintances about the concerns about QAnon. How is it that this conspiracy theory has been able to penetrate so many people's lives?
It's a bizarre development because it's a ridiculous conspiracy theory about child sex trafficking by Democrats. It's absurd. But it has gained the kind of level of an attachment that it has because Trump has tweeted out QAnon material repeatedly. People in the larger, you know, MAGA movement have pushed these ideas. We have a Congresswoman, Marjorie Taylor Greene, here in Georgia, who was just elected and who has worked with QAnon. I mean, this has been an orchestrated effort by conservatives up to and including the president to push these ideas to build their movement. As a result of that, they gave these crazy ideas sanction. And this is a movement that the FBI says is terror-inducing. So that's the kind of ugliness we've seen out of the GOP. We're going to build our base even with a movement that has a deep connection to violence. And now the Republicans have an entrenched constituency of QAnoners in their base. And the rest of us have to deal with the fact that this stuff has been highlighted and people have been radicalized into it.
I don't know where the party goes from here, but according to Parler a couple weeks ago, they were saying down with the GOP. So has this arm of the Republican, you know, support, you know, body ultimately, will it ultimately break off into its own thing?
Well, I think there's going to be a bit of a war over control of what the GOP is going to be, right? Is it a Trump, white nationalist, conspiracy-laden, xenophobic entity? Or is it something like Never Trumpers want, going back to the old vision of, you know, small, low taxes, smaller government? I mean, this is a big question, and it's important for the country because we don't want a political party that's motivated by extremist forces in this country. That would be a disaster. I guess we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Heidi Beirich is the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, and Ryan Devereaux is a staff investigative reporter at The Intercept covering Homeland Security. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over the course of this pandemic, many people have seen their faith tested or strengthened. Now, with the holidays upon us, as we grapple with how to find joy in a moment of deep pain in this country, we wanted to know how your religious practices or faith have evolved in 2020. And you told us a lot of very different experiences on this.
The COVID restrictions in the Seattle area have allowed us to both work from home, which has afforded us the opportunity to have our meals together every evening, which during Hanukkah has allowed us to participate more in rituals of our faith than in years prior. So in a way, it's been an improvement.
Hi, this is Denise from St. Louis, and my faith practices have changed dramatically. I've completely stopped going to church. And in fact, after watching what's happened in this country politically and just the ignorance and cruelty of humans, I really have questioned my faith in God.
My state, California, shut down my church. No one in the church had come down with COVID-19, but we were still prevented from meeting. We could have taken a lot of precautions. We could have done it many ways, but we had to stop meeting. I had attended church virtually every Sunday for all 58 plus years of my life. I now sit in a chair and watch a TV show with my wife. It is not the same. It does not get me the connection with God and other believers that I feel I need so much for freedom of religion in the United States.
Hi, I'm Tom from Oaklawn, Illinois. Even though I've always been an atheist, 2020 has reinforced my opinion that there's no reason to believe that there's some sort of God watching over us. benevolent or otherwise. I'm perfectly content not knowing things like why COVID or what happens to us when we die, because I believe things just happen. It amazes me, though, how, for so many others, a year like 2020 tends to only reinvigorate their faith.
My religion during COVID. I don't really feel like the content of my religion has been compromised at all by COVID. In fact, I'm quite bewildered by those who say that their civil rights have been breached by not being able to meet in their churches. Our faith shows that God is everywhere, and that's within our home or on a Zoom session. It has been really quite an experience for our church to go to a distance type of worship service.
Hi, my name is Julie Bailey, and I'm from the Bronx. My faith has been really impacted. I live alone, and there were times I really thought I was going to die alone, and I really reached out to God in those times, and I really started to reconnect. I'd never really been disconnected from my faith, but I just began to believe and to engage on a much deeper level, because I have a feeling that you have to attach some sort of existential purpose or meaning to all of what's going on, or else, you know, the randomness of this worldwide pandemic becomes too crazy to deal with.
We're going to talk more about faith and religion in this moment and how 10 months of this pandemic have affected how we approach this part of our lives and where we turn for guidance on these issues in upcoming segments. Thank you for sharing your stories with us as always. And if you haven't yet, please let us know your thoughts and experiences by recording a voice memo and sending it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Leave your name and location as well. We're listening to you. It's The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
. 2020 has been a grim year for global press freedom. Journalists have been routinely targeted, harassed, attacked, and even killed for doing their jobs, whether they've been covering government abuse, uprisings against police violence, or the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, a record number of journalists have been jailed this year, at least 274, despite COVID-19 risks. Here to discuss the state of press freedom is Robert Mahoney, Deputy Executive Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hello.
The state of press freedoms before the pandemic, were they better or worse?
No, press freedom has been on the decline globally for the last 5 years, but the pandemic has worsened and accelerated the trend of governments throwing journalists behind bars in order to shut them up.
And so, what are some of the changes that you've seen since the pandemic for press freedom globally?
Well, we've seen a record year of 274 journalists imprisoned this year. That's the highest number in the nearly 30 years that the Committee to Protect Journalists has been documenting these violations against journalists. The number of journalists that have been imprisoned on flimsy charges because they tried to report on the pandemic, on the fact that many governments were unprepared to fight the pandemic and they wanted to control news about that. And so therefore, they either intimidated or jailed journalists. Some of the countries where this has happened has been China, where the pandemic erupted in the first place, and that is still the world's leading jailer of journalists. But it's not just China, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, lots of other countries have really gone out of their way this past year to crack down on the press.
What do some of the threats look like? We talked a little bit about it in the introduction, but what specifically are we talking about? There are journalists who are being imprisoned. Journalists have also been killed.
Yes, many journalists have been killed. But the issue of imprisonment is one that's really important for us because COVID is running rampant through a lot of prisons around the world. And some of the conditions in which journalists are held are really unsanitary. And we have had at least two journalists who have died of COVID-19, which they contracted whilst in prison. So there's a real moral imperative to release journalists, political activists, and political prisoners, because keeping them locked up is endangering their health as well as depriving them of their liberty. And all this is happening at a time when we, citizens, the public, need accurate and timely information about the pandemic, about what it's doing to our health. And in lots of countries where the virus is running rampant, the governments have quashed all kinds of independent reporting, choking off the flow of information to the public.
What is the fear specifically? I mean, and I want to make sure that we're addressing the fact that our own federal government here in the United States has repeatedly, at least President Trump has said that this is a hoax, that COVID-19 isn't real, or that it's something that can easily be remedied. So we're not unique here. But I'm curious, internationally, what is the fear that governments have of accurate reporting around COVID-19?
The fact that it shows that they are weak and dysfunctional. A lot of these dictatorships and authoritarian countries project the image of strength and of being able to deal with threats. Most of them are fighting uprisings internally or politically, and they talk about a war on terror. Now they're fighting an unseen enemy, which is a virus. And so they downplay the virus. They dismiss it as flu. They fake the numbers. They make sure that the public gets to hear only what the government wants to hear. And they crack down on journalists. They also crack down on doctors and nurses that provide information to journalists or themselves go directly to the public over social media. They're desperate to keep the truth bottled up because it makes them look weak and inefficient.
Robert, other than COVID-19 itself, what are some of the other threats to press freedom around the world this year? Specifically thinking about a lot of the social justice uprisings that we've seen here in the United States and abroad.
Yeah, well, the social justice uprisings, the protests, and the way that the authorities here in the U.S. reacted sends a terrible signal to, dictators around the world that this is the way to deal with social protest. We have partnered with other organizations here in the U.S. to track all the violations of press freedom and attacks on journalists over the past year in the States. And we're looking at nearly 1,000 incidents in 79 cities across the U.S. of journalists being attacked or impeded from doing their work. More than 300 journalists have been assaulted this year in the U.S., and the bulk of those assaults have come from law enforcement. And so we have no journalists in jail in the U.S., which is good, but more than 100 were arrested and criminally charged this year just for doing their jobs. And at the last count, we still have 12 journalists facing charges. So all this in a country which used to set an example to many countries in the world about how to deal with a free press and how to enable the press to do its job in a democracy. So we've been setting an awful example, not just this year, but over the last few years.
Robert, I'd also like to talk a little bit about journalists here in the United States and whether or not, I mean, there were some cases, I believe, where journalists were apprehended covering protests, American journalists in particular. Give us a sense of the safety and ability that journalists, American journalists here, well, journalists here in the United States have had or not had during President Trump's administration more broadly.
Well, journalists are out covering, whether it's, demonstrations or just trying to do their jobs here, have had two threats this year in the U.S. One has come from the fear of being arrested or assaulted, mainly by law enforcement. And the other one is staying safe and not contracting the virus. And journalists have adapted pretty quickly to both, but a lot of journalists covering the protest didn't have sufficient protective equipment to be able to deal with being assaulted or gassed or sprayed. So there've been a lot of incidents where journalists have been injured. We had one unfortunate journalist who lost an eye during a protest earlier in the year. So it's been a tough year for journalists. But as I said, they've adapted pretty quickly. That's exactly what we expect them to be able to do to bring us the news. But nearly 1,000 incidents of attacks on journalists in cities across the U.S. and more than 300 journalists assaulted. These are unprecedented numbers in modern times. So I think that the press deserves to be able to do its work here. And the rhetoric that we've seen deployed against journalists, they've been called scum and enemies of the people by President Trump. We hope that that stops and that journalists can go about doing their reporting without being targeted by the head of state.
And, you know, Robert, it's more than the head of state, I think, at this point. I've seen people who are really buying into conspiracy theories right now and saying they distrust all of the quote unquote mainstream media. The president's rhetoric and some of these conspiracy groups that have emerged over the course of his tenure have really had an effect on how average American citizens think about the media as well. What do journalists do there when people just say, we don't trust you? And it appears to, at least it feels like it's a growing number of people. I think that makes us even less safe in doing our jobs.
Yeah, that's part of a strategy where you undermine trust in the media so that no one will believe anything that you say. It's a well-known political ploy, and it's very, very dangerous for press freedom. Because if you undermine the credibility of the media, no matter how much factual reporting you do, no matter how many scoops you have, if people don't believe you, it doesn't matter. I think that the example has to come from the top to begin with. I think if our leadership models the behavior that they would like to see in a free democracy, whether you have a functioning press, then I think things will improve. Not just here, but overseas. And at the Committee to Protect Journalists, we've put forward some proposals for the incoming Biden administration, which we hope will help repair some of the damage which has been done over the past 4 years. We would love President-elect Biden to make a very strong declaration when he takes office of how his administration will support press freedom and value the work of the press in a democracy, not just here, but around the world, so that the U.S. will walk the walk as well as talk the talk when it comes to saying we have a free press and we value First Amendment values. Then I would love for that administration to appoint a special envoy for press freedom. It would be for a few years, but that person would be able to speak out on press matters, condemn attacks on journalists, and work to restore some of the confidence that we need in the press. If we can't believe an independent media as citizens, then we are open to more conspiracy theories and bad actors pumping misinformation and lies into our information world, and just leaves us confused and afraid.
As a journalist myself, Robert, I have to say I agree with you. And I hope that we can get on a better path. Robert Mahoney is the Deputy Executive Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your interest in this really important subject.
We're all looking for some wisdom and comfort lately. Back in 1994, Jerry Seinfeld gave us some sage advice on his television show that may just help us get through these tough times.
If people would only look to the cookie, all our problems would be solved.
Well, we're taking Jerry's advice and ending the show today with a look at the holiday cookie and how the centuries-old tradition of baking cookies during this time of the year became a staple of our modern holiday season. Michael Crondall is a food writer, culinary historian, and the author of Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So, the cookie, where did this delicious treat come from?
Oh dear, cookies go way back, probably back to gingerbread and little gingerbread morsels from the Middle Ages when you would get these exotic spices, expensive spices coming in from the Far East. And these precious morsels would be made for special holidays, not necessarily for Christmas, but any sort of special holiday, because what did they have in them? They had honey because they didn't have sugar in Europe at the time. And cloves and cinnamon and all these things that were in many ways considered literally the aroma of paradise because they came from this Eastern magical place. There was a lot of hype around this sort of thing in those days.
So did everybody eat what was then considered a cookie, or was this reserved for the upper echelon of society?
Well, everybody in cities, because this would be something that regular people would eat on very, very special occasions. For the super rich, you know, there was nothing special about this. But this might be the sort of thing that might be reserved for, you know, a very special event, St. Nicholas Day in the Netherlands, for example, or Christmas. That's the thing about cookies, right? Cookies are special because 100 years ago, 150 years ago, they included expensive ingredients that people would really only pull out for these, you know, occasions two or three times a year. And this is why they become associated with holidays.
So there is one cookie, I mean, there are many cookies that we're baking for the holidays, but there's one thing that stood out to me, particularly this year, as I see a lot of people posting images on Facebook, and it is the gingerbread house. Where did this idea come from to make not just gingerbread cookies, but gingerbread houses with frosting and entire communities around them?
I love gingerbread houses. There used to be these competitions in New York. I guess we're not having that anymore, where hotels would fight it out who had the best gingerbread house. Gingerbread houses, like so many traditions that we have, like Christmas trees, for example, are a German thing, right? Think Hansel and Gretel. What Hansel and Gretel are find in the forest is a gingerbread house. So they come in, you know, in the 19th century, again, like so many of these Germanic kind of traditions, and are adapted or adopted by Americans. And gingerbread houses are pretty simple to begin with, but of course they get more elaborate as the decades go on.
And of course there are those who bake Christmas cookies in the shape of things like Christmas trees and ornaments and very elaborate cookies. Where did that tradition come from?
There is this really old tradition, and there's records of this actually in the Middle Ages in southern Italy, of baking cookies in the shape of people's limbs. And what they would do is that they would then bring them to church and have these things blessed. And consequently, the part, you know, you would bring an arm in that would hurt, or your leg in, it would hurt, and it would then be cured through this blessing. People would do the same thing with hearts, right? So you would give somebody a gingerbread heart as a literal way of saying, hey, I kind of like you. And so this goes into Santa Claus, so that the Dutch make these Sinterklaas or St. Nicholas cookies. And when you eat these cookies, in a sense, you're imbibing some of that saintliness of the saint. So in a sense, you eat a Christmas tree, you're eating Christmas, you know, you're eating the special holiday experience.
Are we the only ones here in the United States who bake cookies around this time of year, or is this more of a global phenomenon? Or are there things that people in other countries are baking now that are not cookies?
I think that, again, this idea of Christmas cookies, like the idea of the gingerbread, like the idea of the Christmas tree, comes from, you know, kind of the Germanic part of Europe. So in Germany, and particularly in places like Austria, the Czech Republic, and sort of that Central European area, they have a vast repertoire of Christmas cookies. And Christmas cookies are definitely a huge thing. I'm Czech originally, and there are cookbooks devoted to Christmas cookies. So that is picked up in the United States, of course, sometime in the 19th century. And these are the two kind of, you know, super Christmas cookie superpowers. In England, there's still this kind of association with, you know, fruitcake and steamed pudding like you have in all those songs. The French, of course, have their Bûche de Noël. And the bûche, which originally was supposed to imitate this log that would burn for 12 days, the 12 days of Christmas, has now turned into, sometimes it looks like a log, but again, these days in Parisian patisseries, there's this tremendous competition between the pastry makers, and the Bûche de Noël has become anything but a bûche. They'll turn it into a school bus, they'll turn it into a palace, all sorts of very imaginative and expensive treats for the holiday.
How has the pandemic affected our cookie-making tradition?
You know, I was looking at some stats, and we, of course, don't have stats for today, but we do have stats of about a month ago, and apparently the butter sales in this country are going off the charts. Apparently, they have sold something like 20% more butter this year as of November than they did all of last year. And don't forget that all the restaurants, or many of the restaurants, are closed, right? So people are cooking at home. And what do they do with butter? Let's face it, cookies are butter, sugar, and flour. And I'm not sure that we can, we have any statistics on this, but I bet a heck of a lot of that butter is going into cookies this year.
Michael, are there any excellent favorite holiday cookie recipes that you might want to share? Is there one cookie in particular that you think marks the season?
You know, I do think that gingerbread has this centuries-old tradition. So anything with gingerbready kind of qualities, gingerbread men, gingerbread trees, is so deep in kind of European Christmas culture. I happen to think that it's whatever your culture is, right? So I'm coming from the Czech Republic. For us, various kinds of vanilla crescents are quintessentially Christmassy. For others, it's various kinds of stars, jam-filled cookies. I think in the United States, what really says Christmas, though, is decorated cookies. So kind of a simple cookie, but cut into all sorts of fun shapes and, you know, go crazy with the decoration.
Michael Crondall is a food writer, culinary historian, and author of Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Michael, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Another Thursday in the can, everybody. Really appreciate you all tuning in. Amy Walter will be with you tomorrow. And before I go, a quick shout out to the amazing team that puts this show together every week. Our board operator is Vince Fairchild. Our director and sound designer is Jake Howitt. Jackie Martin and Jose Olivares were our line producers. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. The Takeaways producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is our executive producer. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcasts, and you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, call us about any story ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.